All right, everybody, welcome back to the Buck Starts Here, Mexican American War Edition. I'm Future Kyle coming in because my wonderfully verbose co-host Eric had twice as much material to cover than we initially expected. That's okay, because now the war is going to actually start doing war things. So last episode, we set the scene. Bad maps, worse diplomacy, Polk aggressively manifesting destiny, and two countries inching toward a fight while pretending it was an accident. Well, today is where the shooting starts, the strategies get spicy, and Zachary Taylor casually invents modern warfare while everyone else is still fighting like Napoleon. This is part two of the Mexican-American War, where cities fall faster than anyone expects, the Navy decides it owns every coastline, and Santa Anna refuses to accept that artillery is in fact a problem. We're talking battlefield innovations, political panic, and one general who absolutely did not come here to conquer Mexico, but somehow kept winning anyway. So grab a drink, stretch your legs, if you still have them, and prepare for an absolutely unhinged tour through the part of the war where Santa Anna just would not admit defeat, which probably explains why Illinois still has his leg in a museum. Now let's get buck wild.
So now that we've set the stage for the Mexican-American War, what's interesting is that, well, the war is beautifully complex, and there's books and everything written on it. If we talk about it from the level that we discuss on the podcast, what's interesting, it's more interesting to discuss the actors in the war. It's more interesting to discuss the economics of it. Fighting, which obviously that's a much different show than what we do. We know, not military history as much as I love it. The war actually ends quite quickly. The war is almost lost immediately by Mexico. So after we have in 1825, after war is declared, and we see the 1600 Mexican cavalry ambushed patrol of dragoons. Dragoons are basically mounted infantry that dismount.
It's like heavy cavalry, right? Isn't there?
No,
are they just armed, like with long-range weapons?
There's no there's a horse that doesn't armor or anything. They ride the horse somewhere and jump off. They're more like scout. They're actually they just tend to be very well trained and carry heavy weapons, but it's not like the horses armored and stuff.
Okay, okay.
So Taylor had 3,500 men at Fort Texas just before the hostilities started on April 25th. 1,600. Strong Mexican cavalry. So remember, they only had 40,000 troops to start with, so this is 4% of their entire army. Mm-hmm. Ambushed a patrol of U.S. dragoons, and they killed and captured 60 American troops. This is where Polk hits us with the famous American blood on American soil. Like we discussed earlier, May 13th, 1846 comes around. War is declared. Well, Congress is deliberating this. There is a siege of the fort in the Battle of Palo Alto, mm-hmm. and this happened between May 3rd and May 9th. So this is actually feeding into Polk's argument. And there's a Mexican general, General Arista, and he basically sieged Fort Texas, which he was trying to – he was using artillery to siege them. So this mm-hmm. is actually – when we talk about like battery unit, this is actually one of the few examples I can give you of planned – Mexican planned battery fire.
Gotcha. Okay.
So General Taylor's like, we're still not declared yet, but General Taylor needs to act. So he takes 2,300 troops. He has garrisoned on a coastal supply point named Point Isabel, and he marches them. He himself marches them to Palo Alto, to Fort Texas. And so he arrives there around May 8th. So it takes him almost 5 days to get there. And he meets the 6,000 Mexican troops. There's some different estimates. Some say it's as low as 3,400. Some say it's as high as 6,000. It was 6,000 total, including like logistic troops and stuff like that.
Okay, so like the cooks and like all the support units and everything else.
Exactly. Yeah. So the tail to teeth ratio, right?
So yeah, isn't that like usually like, what is it, like 10% fighting force for 90% support? Is that roughly
the estimate? I think the U.S. is as high as 14 to 1 now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and your casualties get higher the less tail you have. So, like, I think Russia's down to, like, 1 to 8. So this is where we get into kind of the cool stuff. So at least if you're a military history nerd, right? So with only 2,300 troops, Taylor goes to relieve Fort Texas. He arrives on May 8th, and we have the Battle of Palo Alto. And Taylor's fighting 6,000 Mexican troops on an open plain just outside the fort. Mm-hmm. And Taylor, Now, remember, this is cool. This is a guy who started his military service in, you know, the first decade of the 1800s. It's crazy to me.
Yeah.
And he's now leading what might feel like leading an alien army in terms of weaponry different. But he's just a good general. Yeah. And he understands technology. And he didn't try and fight a war of the past. So he deploys what's known as flying artillery. Now, flying artillery is what we now would call field artillery. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a name for it yet. And by the way, I got a couple of weird, like, when I was reading this, like, some people say this is where the term field artillery comes from because the battlefield had a literal field on it, and that's where he used the artillery to basically fire over these flat prairies
right
at the enemy. And they go, oh, he's using field artillery, like the artillery's being used on field. I don't know if that's true. I don't think that's true. That sounds weird to me. But basically, this concentrated cannon fire, and this is where, dude, this is where Zachary Taylor, I would never want to fight this guy. He did this to set the dry grass ablaze, making it impossible for Mexico to mount cavalry charges. Oh. This is the first time they realized, like, oh, wait a minute, we can defeat these cavalry charges. Zachary Taylor, having a lot of respect for his enemy, was like, they have elite artillery.
Their strongest unit on the field. Let me figure out a way to neutralize it.
Yeah. And so they end up setting the field on fire. Mexico can't do any cavalry charges. This devolves into a kind of a day-long duel of cannons mm-hmm. between the Mexican artillery brought to besiege the fort and this field artillery, which, again, I mean, he pulled artillery very quickly in here, so it was smaller artillery too. The Mexicans didn't really have an answer to this. So kind of what we discussed earlier with this use of howitzers, these use of really professional artillery, this ends up with 9 Americans being killed and 47 being wounded. It ends up with 320 Mexican mm-hmm. troops being killed and another 380 being wounded. It is the first taste where Zachary Taylor's like, this is going to be interesting. This is going to be a much different war than what he's used to fighting. Remember, this is also a man who's very comfortable being far away from supply lines.
Yeah, right.
Now,
we learned from the Seminole Wars.
Exactly. And to bring up the Seminole Wars, this battle continues to May 9th. And the Mexicans start strategically withdrawing. Taylor, similar to what he did in the Seminole Wars, was like, oh, I'm not going to let my guys reconstitute. So he starts pursuing Arista, and he finds the Mexican army, and it's entrenched in this dry riverbed.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mexican army is basically like, oh, we can,
try to hold out there.
Yeah, they basically say we can repel this attack. Zachary Taylor, I don't like to say it's luck because it's Zachary Taylor. Like he's a great general, and it's not fair to be like, oh, he got luck. But obviously, there's all this thick desert brush, this riverbed, which even today we tend to build ditches around our forward observation bases because it's just physics. It doesn't matter how modern your weapons are; it's just physics. It's very hard to come up a hill, especially if you're getting fired at.
Yep.
But Zachary Taylor empowers Captain Charles May. He says, "Take infantry and take your dragoons, get in there, but don't worry about attacking the army in the riverbed first. Go knock out their artillery." So as infantry is entering this riverbed and it's all this close quarter fighting, again, the advantage of having, you know, 6-shot revolvers, especially at this close, the Mexicans are like, oh, let's turn to our artillery and try and cut off the Americans before they get in the riverbed, especially because they're coming over this peak. Remember, Mexico is still using direct fire cannons.
Right.
So they're still very close to the front. And so Mexico is like, this is our ace in the hole. We'll make it impossible to come over the top. Charles May's dragoons maneuver around the battlefield and end up wiping out the Mexican artillery.
Luck. That's just smart tactics.
Right. To the Mexican line, because of exactly the tactics, collapses. And Arista's soldiers start routing, and they're trying to get back across the Rio. Now, remember, like, not strong logistic chain, so they're over the Rio. This is the idea of battle scarcity, too. They know they can't sustain this battle.
Yeah.
Despite this chaotic and literally running into essentially the entire 1,600-man force that had come over to besiege Fort Texas, The U.S. will lose on this day. 33 troops will be killed. 89 will be injured. Well, Mexico, Arista reports that 547 casualties, killed, wounded, and missing. Americans estimate that over 1,000 Mexican casualties occurred. We're not really sure. I kind of hate this one. Because they're two different methodologies. Arista was counting all his reported troops. So I don't think he's lying about his numbers, just for the record. Like, I think he's literally taking a tally here. Mm-hmm. Where America is like basically like, okay, we have this many dead enemy troops, and we have this many captured, and we think this is roughly how many people would have gotten away injured. So theirs is more kind of a logical assessment. The rest is like, I think, like straight off a call sheet.
Oh, okay. So they're like kind of like estimating, like we probably injure 3 people for every killed.
100% right, Cal.
Okay.
So this is known as a twin victory for Taylor. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, just pushes him even higher up in American history. Mexico not only retreats back over the Rio, they actually abandon the entire city of Matamoros across the border. By this time, the war started. This is kind of wild because they declare war on like May 13th in the U.S. By May 18th, he's actually taken over the city of Matamoros. And Taylor was kind of interesting on there. So there's a couple different stuff I read where he was like, I didn't want to do this, like, but that's American territory. He felt like he was very empowered to do whatever he needed to do. Almost like whoever can control the area is the person who gets the property. Right? That's a horrible way for life to be. I don't like, I'm not a, what do they call that? A cultural realist. Like, I don't believe in that. I don't believe in strongman theory.
Did he install his own governor?
No, he didn't. He kind of didn't know what to do. He was like, guys, I took this over because I don't want like them to take it over again. But like, What do you want me to do here? Because Taylor was like, we got the Rio Grande. Like, I'm happy. That's what we want. Cool. I did my job. Like, yeah, you did your job really well, dude. Like, okay.
A little too well.
literally, like, I think you did that a little too well. So we go to the summer of 1846. The U.S. comes up with this thing called the three-prong invasion plan. And this is where I think Polk and Taylor start kind of disagreeing. Because Polk has this expansionist strategy. And he wants to launch this multi-frontal war. And Taylor's like, whatever you want to do, Mr. President, but my job is to secure the U.S. border. I'm going to fortify Matamoros. I'm going to make sure that there's really no way for a campaign to reignite in the northeastern Mexico. Do whatever you want to do. I'm not the president. And Polk's probably like, okay, so I got my MVP holding down the fort, literally. That's right. Cool as shit. I'm going to do whatever I want now because I literally can't lose because you got to go fight Zach Taylor, who essentially invented field artillery. And that's probably really scary. Polk's like, I got like 10 years of being able to use that tactic. So I just like the idea that he set fire to the brush to be like, you can't use your artillery. That gets back to Polk. He's probably like, I want. This is all bonus money. It's free real estate. So
how much longer do we have in this war? That sounds like it's pretty much over a week into it.
I have probably 3 pages left, and they move fairly quick. Okay. Polk turns to General John E. Wool, which is kind of a cool name, and he goes, you are now the army of a center. He gives them 2,000 men from San Antonio to head towards northern Mexico. He calls it Army of the Center. He then turns to Colonel Kearney, Stephen W. Kearney.
Kearney,
he
goes, I've heard that name before.
Yeah, he's an interesting cat. He goes, you are now the Army of the West. Here's 16, a little over 1,600 men, but he gives them.
What a cool name.
Yeah, it is. The 1st U.S. Dragoons, the Missouri Volunteers, which are wildly competent. I mean, they were used by Zachary Taylor in the Seminole Wars. They're incredibly robust. These are not your normal militiamen. These men know how to brawl. And then a battalion of Mormons, which I just think they literally are called the Mormon Battalion.
Actually, yes.
Yeah, they're called the Mormon Battalion.
Yeah, I remember that.
Apparently, they were also very good fighters. But he basically is like, you have a smaller army. You're not a general. You're just a colonel, which this guy's motivated to become a general. He's like, I'm just going to give you like our incredibly good offensive-minded troops and go get at them. So by August 18th, Kearney marches unopposed all the way to Santa Fe, New Mexico. The Mexican governor, he flees, and New Mexico is taken without a shot being fired. Kearney raises the flag in Santa Fe. He establishes this American civil military authority in the territory that actually lasts a fair while. To be honest, there's nothing really offensive about him. He's just like, oh, damn, that would have been cool. Then he's like, well, this is America now. So you guys haven't elected anybody yet. So we're going to have like a military authority in the territory. But can, like, you just figure it out. Congress will figure this out. We'll deal with it later. But like, go live your lives. And the people were like, do we have to do anything? And he's like, no. They're like,
okay.
Okay, cool. And he's probably like, oh, I had the MVP team. I didn't even need to use them. Harrison's like, in, like looking down from heaven, probably being like,
nice work.
Good job. You'd have to fire a shot. Did the best. You outmaneuvered him. But by this point, the governor of New Mexico, and again, it's important to remember, it's not like these are like tyrannical rulers. This isn't like anything like that.
Right.
But he was just like, dude, I'm not going to, like, I can't hold this place. They can't get me any men up here.
Right.
After he establishes Kearney, he's like, I need to make my name. So he says to Polk,
there's a town in Arizona named Kearney, now that I remember that.
There's a reason for it. Okay. Yeah, because it used to be part of California.
Yeah.
Because he goes to, this is so, I don't know why I find this guy, I shouldn't find this as funny as I do, but he knows Polk wants California. So he kind of says to Polk, he's like, I'm going to go to California. And Polk's not like, oh, don't do that. He's just like, oh, you're going to go to California. So he leaves on September 25th. He takes a small detachment of dragoons, just 300, which is like, dude, you're going to essentially invading a different part of the world. What are you doing? So by...
Spawning the conquistadors plan here.
Yeah. You're like this one. So by the time he gets to California, and I don't know if he knew this was happening, the U.S. Navy had made its way all around South America and had come up. Like, this is still the Caribbean fleet, Kyle. So like, this is still the Caribbean fleet.
Do you know what if they went through down by South Africa or South America, like, you know how dangerous that strait is down there?
It's like literally the most dangerous waters in the world. So he comes up again, I think this got out of hand for Polk, kind of, where he was just like, oh guys, so quick question. I'm not a geographer, but the Caribbean fleet is in California? Yes. That's just a different ocean. Like, yeah, we really beat the Mexican Navy, and we don't think they're making any new boats. He's like, cool. I guess you're on the Pacific Coast now. So by September 25th, Kearney's headed off to California. During this time period, 1846, the U.S. Navy under Commodore Slott had seized Monterey and San Francisco, and basically a bunch of Navy personnel went on land. This is where they had like the Bear Flag Revolt, which is just, that's just the Bear Flag Republic. That's California declaring independence from Mexico. Mm-hmm. One of the U.S. Commodores, Robert Stockton, he occupied Los Angeles. It's kind of in
California. I know.
there was a revolt that took over Los Angeles. And by, like, basically, there's not like Mexican military. Let's think of the more like Mexican militiamen. They revolted and retook Los Angeles. There was no army. There was just some dudes like, I guess you're part of America now.
Right.
Kearney shows up after traveling 2,000 miles to California. and another, this colonel, Donovan, who we mentioned earlier, the one who stopped the execution of
Joseph Smith.
Of Joseph Smith. He gets there and he's just like, like, for lack of a better term, he basically helps overtake California. And at this point, the people who overtook California, Los Angeles, were just like, oh, like, we kind of did this because nobody was here. It's like, oh, because nobody's here. That's how you take something over. This seems to be the main theory of this war. But Donovan is basically told, hey, go down to Chihuahua, Mexico, with your volunteer comment. And he goes down there. There's some Mexican forces down there. Those Mexican forces are just completely, like, they're cut off from everybody. They don't really kind of know what's going on. He goes down there. He starts fighting them. They're just like, oh, I guess, like, cool. We're, like, I guess we're having a battle. They eventually capitulate quite quickly.
Stop fighting us.
You know, that's kind of what they were like, because they weren't getting ordered. It was disheveled. The Mexican government's arguing with each other. The next major engagement we have is a two-day battle that takes place in late September, September 21st to September 23rd, the Battle of Monterey. By this point, Taylor is ordered to basically take complete control, not over northeastern Mexico, but northern Mexico. Mm-hmm. So he takes his troops and he marches them all the way to Monterey, which is defended by about 9,000 Mexican troops are garrisoned there. Taylor only has 6,200 troops. It's a mixture of regulars, but also a lot of newly arrived volunteers who are all amped up to go fight. And he decides to bring his... I kind of like this one. So he brings a mix of you know, regulars, these volunteers, and actually decides to take the city, not through artillery bombardment, but street by street, house to house, fighting.
And that's baller.
So as Zachary Taylor's here, he employs General...
Sorry, was that in order to protect civilians?
It was a... I think it was in order to protect civilians.
Yeah, because he was doing everything with artillery before, and it just seems like he didn't want to indiscriminately bomb a civilian population.
Yeah, I think, I think that's too... I mean, the concept of even bombarding a city, I think, was probably weird to Taylor, because he's not big like, you know, you fight... Soldiers fight soldiers. That's his. Right. Like, he's a soldier's one. But he also, I think he didn't see it as effective too, because he's like, what am I going to do? Bomb the crap out of them? How does that solve the problem there? Like, it's a city. So he employs one of his generals, generally William Worth. He goes, hey, as we're fight, you know, take your men. We're going to start fighting house to house, street to street. I want you to flank the city. And so Worth goes out there and he's flanking the city just as he's ordered. But he continually sends, he basically continues to send these small detachments out there to take over all these Mexican strongholds. And throughout the days they're fighting, it's very intense, very bloody fighting. The Mexicans have the high ground. Mm-hmm. But what Wirt starts noticing from his position is the defenders start yielding ground. And they keep falling back to this central plaza. And casualties are mounting. The Mexicans can't hold up against this. And again, it's door-to-door fighting.
Right.
It's going to benefit the people with the more advanced weapon. Now, the general in charge of all these troops, he basically is cornered into this plaza on the 24th. And he appeals to Taylor and to Worth. And it's just like, hey, can I surrender? And very interesting enough, he turns to them and says, of course, like Taylor and Worth are not blood hungry. Like, right. They're not. And so the general's like, well, how do you want to do this? And he says, well, this Taylor's like, this is a garrison. This is a real garrison. This isn't like, you know, this is a Mexican garrison. So he allows them to, they agree to an 8 weeks armistice, and he allows the troops to withdraw with their arms.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because he's like, this is a garrison. Like, Taylor had this weird, like, he's a military man. He's like, all right, it's not like you were in the open field fighting us and stuff like that.
Oh, because it was just a city garrison. They're just protecting their civilians.
Yep. And so Taylor's like, hey, I understand the military aspect of this. Taylor doesn't want to press the war. In Taylor's opinion, his job is to enforce the Rio Grande as the border. Hey, you're moving troops further away from the border. Fantastic. I don't have to kill you. So basically... Taylor believes his orders are to occupy northern Mexico, not to conquer the entire nation. So Taylor is like, yeah, go move further away from the border. This is also the only time that, I think this is the only battle where U.S. casualties outnumber Mexican casualties. So there was 488 U.S. casualties and 367 Mexican casualties. But in terms of if you fight a siege war, that was incredibly effective. Usually it's a 3-1 loss.
I was going to say, usually you need 3x the defending force in order to take a city like that.
Yeah. So Taylor is very excited. Now, the Battle of Monterrey is considered effectively ending the war based on the terms of war was started. Northern Mexico is now completely devoid. There is no troops anywhere that can threaten the Rio Grande, and Polk and the War Department absolutely flip out at Taylor. They are angry. They hate the armistice. And
they're mad that he ended the war.
orders Polk to violate the armistice that he he set. He was like, "Nope, that does, he doesn't use the term traitor, but basically says he hates that you allowed an army to escape, and that you had no authority to agree to a truce." And Taylor's just like, "Hey, you come down here and fight me first off." And he refuses the order to violate the armistice. He's just like, "No." And at this point, Taylor's already super famous. Yeah. Taylor's already considered the best general in America by a huge margin. His troops love him, and he's like, No. And this is a man who's already accomplished insane feats even before the Mexican-American War. And he's like, the job is to secure northern Mexico. And he got honestly kind of chippy with Polk. Like, he was almost like,
oh, I love that.
Yeah, he was almost like, why would we need to pursue them? Why? Mexico still needs an army. And that's when it's a little like,
mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting. Yeah. So as the war starts coming to what's going to be its natural, what I would call this, the falling action. And the falling action extends a little bit, but the war's turned now. Everything's been accomplished. You secured northern Mexico. That means you secured California, New Mexico, Monday, Arizona, Texas, all secured. Who would have guessed you set Taylor loose for 6 months, 4 months. And it's like, oh, everything's won. And we invented new forms of warfare and are somehow persecuting it ethically. Like, this is insane. I know, right?
We should have kept him around a lot longer.
Yeah, we do see the fall of the Mexican president. Santa Anna retakes the presidency for the second time, and he returns from exile in 1846. And ironically, he returns to exile with the help of some secret diplomacy from James Polk, who had arranged safe passage of Santa Anna through the U.S. naval blockade.
I think I remember hearing something about that.
Yeah, and basically saying, like, hey, buddy, like, you get to, you know, you lay back there, cede the territory, negotiate peace. But anyway, it's when Santa Anna gets back here and negs on everything and commands the Mexican army and wants to fight on. He's elected president, I always say in quotation marks. Right. And he musters this huge army to drive back the quote-unquote invaders. At the same time, the North, General Wool, the Army of the Center, he joins with Taylor's forces. And by December, he strengthens his U.S. position to really one of the most powerful land forces in the entire continent. And as December rolls around, the U.S. is just basically occupying the northern area with this, it would be effectively an unstoppable army.
Yeah.
The U.S. Navy at this point, it can't get enough of itself. It's going around the Gulf of Mexico.
It's stuck on the wrong continent, wrong side of the continent.
It's like half of it's just,
dude,
you know,
what are you guys doing
up
there in Alaska?
It decides to just on its own to seize a port in late November, which is like it's just like the last like major supply line. By this time, Colonel, at the same time that the U.S. Navy is just like, you don't get a port anymore, and they take Tampico in November of 1846. Kearney's troops, who are just exhausted because they're just walking around all the time. Like, they're just like
just done the Oregon Trail walk, basically.
Yeah. And then they went back through the desert because Kearney's like, I want to be a general. Who would I have to kill to become a general? And they're like, dude, relax. So they end up having this battle of San Pasqual in California. And Kearney takes 100 dragoons and because he had like basically left a rear guard. And they clash with the rebels. They have a mounted cavalry, about 150 men. I'm not trying to like be funny here.
Yeah.
But the Lancers attack, and they, you know, we're near San Diego now. The Lancers attack, and they're charging on weary mules. That's how everybody keeps calling them weary mules.
Aww.
It's a rain, a rain soaked field, but it's relatively successful. Like, Kearney's troops, that he takes 18 are killed and some are wounded and fighting, but he only has 100 men. So he's pretty much like,
oh, they're not able to shoot either if you said it's rainy.
Yeah. I mean, it's just this horrible scenario, but I do like the term that I've read in like two different sources, weary mules.
That's quite the insult.
So basically, Kearney's men, they end up taking the hilltop overnight. They're surrounded by the enemy, but the U.S. Navy sends a bunch of Marines in to reach them the next day.
Yeah.
And technically, both sides were like, we won. But the Americans, we ended up with San Diego. And I often wonder, what the Marines thought, if they were like, oh, the other side's like, we won. It's like, we got off boats, came here, and now we have San Diego. What do you mean you won? What did you win? Yeah,
we did it.
So U.S. troops begin to occupy New Mexico, California, all of northern Mexico, but Mexico refuses to surrender. And we get to the last major action of the war before we see the coup de grace of it, which is in January of 1847, Santa Anna throughout the year since he had come back, had been building up a massive army for a counterstrike. So after the Mexicans aren't surrendering, they form this massive army. Early January runs around. Kearney basically is able to reconsolidate his troops with the Marines in California. He ends up winning the Battle of San Gabriel and the Battle of La Mesa near Los Angeles. This is kind of the death blow in California. By January 13th, the Mexican militiamen pretty much pushed all the way back, and they end up signing a treaty that ends the war in Southern California. New Mexico, basically there's a brief insurgency with some of the, because Kearney's, so many of Kearney's men left, they're not expecting the
dude, it's 300 Mexican people to handle three of like the largest states in the Union. That's not enough people.
So he's basically like, oh no, like like these rebels line up. But one of his compatriots, Colonel Price, he turns around, absolutely crushes them.
Did he get the generalship, hopefully?
I believe he does eventually become a general. Yeah. the Missouri Volunteers, they start moving into Mexico too, and they end up defeating these. They end up, I mean, the Missouri, this is, I mean, the Missouri Riflemen, they get the, they really earn the reputation of the Missouri militiamen, because they, as they're marching to California, they end up running into the battle near Chihuahua, which is near the Sacramento River, and with only 900 men, they went on the attack against 3,000 members of the Mexican army who were in the city of Chihuahua. And basically what Doniphan does is he manages to attack so vigorously in the front and then collapse on the front, on the flanks, that despite having a 3-4 times advantage, they aren't able to maneuver at all, and ends up compressing this force within the city. And he doesn't stop. He then enters the city. He attacks. And they basically...
furious.
Yeah, they basically have nothing. They don't know what to do. So as we start leaving early 1847, Mexico City is still in this impression that they can win the war. And the Mexican army's like, what do you do? Every time we fight them, they're beating us on 4-1 odds when we hold cities. Like, we're just outmanned and outbattled here. We have the great battle. We have the Battle of Buena Vista, when that's when Santa Anna personally marches 15,000 men up towards Taylor's relatively, and I use this term broadly, relatively smaller force in northern Texas. Now, Zachary Taylor had allowed his regulars to go and help out in other theaters of the war. So yeah. Zachary Taylor's leading a small group, a small army of 4,800 that is primarily made up of volunteer soldiers. And this is because the Veracruz expedition was going on. Taylor understood they needed more seasoned troops.
Yeah.
And he wasn't going to send volunteers who hadn't been hardened yet to one of the bloodiest, he knew would be one of the bloodiest battles in U.S. history. So he takes a defensive, so Taylor gathers his troops. They go over to Buena Vista and they take up this defensive position. On February 22nd, Santa Anna launches this attack, and he leads the attack by demanding Taylor surrender with a message boasting his superior numbers. And Taylor responds with very classic Taylorism, go to hell. That is what he says. He said, he told him, he goes, tell him to go to hell. And by February 23rd, the battle kicks off. It's a day, it's, you know, day long fighting. It's across the land's rocky. It's arid. But the, you know, Bragg's flying artillery, manages to just wipe out the Mexican assault. And Santa Anna's solution to this was to send denser and denser columns of American lines.
Why?
And this is known as the French tactic. This is what I was referencing earlier about the Napoleonic tactics. At one point, he manages to flank the U.S. position. But a flank is useless if your center column is not there. Then it's just a weak group of people attacking from the side.
Yeah, it's just a bunch of people out by themselves, out behind enemy lines.
And at one point, a regiment for Indiana is overwhelmed and starts breaking and routing. And in any other time in human history up to this point, that usually is the end of the battle. That means everybody will fall. But again, the Mexicans are refusing to understand modern artillery. They're just like, it keeps beating them down, and they just, it's almost like they don't want to admit how powerful artillery is at this point. He's called the king of the battle for a reason. After the Indiana regiment has to rout because it got overwhelmed, the artillery's already zeroed in on that position and launches one of the most withering attacks, like to the point where, like, we have several accounts from several different soldiers there of just getting mowed down. And Santa Anna, not, you know, following military training, says, oh, look, we broke the flank. Let's keep pouring troops in there.
Oh, no.
And he's not understanding that the artillery's not stopping. Like, the artillery is not going to stop until you stop. And then the artillery pauses. And, you know, Santa Anna's kind of excited. Maybe they ran out
of shells or something.
Yeah, ran out of shell. So, but they didn't. They paused because Zachary Taylor ordered a counterattack by Charles May. Charles May's dragoons quickly ran to the battlefield, dismount with carbines and six shooters, and blunt the attack. The attack stops progressing forward, and now all the people trying to exploit the flank are getting bottled up.
Oh, gosh. It's just a shooting gallery then.
Zachary Taylor turns to Captain Brack, who's the flying artillery, the field artillery, and says, a little more grape, Captain Bragg, meaning grape shot.
Oh, gosh.
And it completely collapsed the attack and ends up getting repositioned. It is the bloodiest days of the war. Santa Anna is confused. He doesn't understand why he can't dislodge the Americans. He's like, these are less trained troops. Because he's just like not admitting that artillery is a thing. He's reluctant to accept that the U.S. Navy has cut off all their supplies. There is no positive outcome here. So as the war kind of, to be short, I mean, I don't mean to be overly, blunt here. Santa Anna just is he finally gets to the realization that he's not going to be able to do anything here. Some people say it was the presence of the grape shot. Like, he witnessed just... And so it's like, even when I win, I lose. But he did believe in the doctrine. Like, he believed, like, this is how you prosecute a war. Basically, after that, he leaves Buena Vista. The Americans lost, had casualties of around 739. 264 killed, 450 wounded. They had 26 missing. The Mexicans reported 2,000 wounded. Mm. Santa Anna reported back to Mexico City that it was a victory. Because I captured an American flag and a cannon.
You got to spin it some way, right?
Yeah. Mexico would never mount another attack in northern Mexico ever again. And northern Mexico would now become the southern U.S. border because it was just fascinating because Santa Anna tried. He's not a bad general. He really isn't. But he was fighting a war from 30 years before. It's called the French tactics.
Yeah, he's 40 years too late.
Taylor is now pretty much effectively done for the rest of the war. Santa Anna regroups his troops, heads south because the siege of Veracruz had taken place. Mm-hmm. And this is where Polk's third front opens up. A amphibious landing is actually conducted. The first large-scale amphibious landing is conducted at Veracruz in March 9th. It's overseen by the general-in-chief at this point, Winfield Scott, of Civil War fame. He's given command of 12,000 troops, and he's told to invade central Mexico by land. So he assembles this massive force in the Lobos Islands, and he's escorted by Commodore Perry. Yes, that Commodore Perry.
Damn the torpedoes.
This is the dude. This is the guy who opened up freaking Japan. And they land at Veracruz on March 9th, 1847. It's the first large-scale amphibious landing in U.S. history. There was some battle. There was some,
opposition?
I'm trying to think the right word. Yeah, let's say opposition, which was quickly silenced by U.S. Navy guns. Mm-hmm. This was also the first amphibious landing ever that was done under combined arms. That's got to be scary, dude. Like, you're like, oh, I'm gonna be able to attack these troops when they get on the beach. And it's like, why is somebody lobbing small cars at me that explode? It's like, meet the U.S. Navy. It's like, oh, they're here?
Why are they? I
thought they were just watching. It's like, no, they're part of this too. It's like, I don't want them to be part of this. The U.S. lands in Veracruz. It's defended by about 4,300 Mexican troops under General Morales. So after they attempt a costly frontal assault, Scott's like, hey, Maybe this isn't going to work. And like, we have good supply lines, but we don't have like infinite supply lines. So he orders a bombardment of the fort using U.S. He has U.S. field cannons. And but the Navy's also like, yeah, let's go. We're probably kind of pumped to this. Yeah,
that's what we're excited to do. Lob some shells from a distance.
Yeah, so they end up bombarding the heck out of this, essentially citadel. It's actually the civilians end up rising up and are like, can we stop this? Like, why is this going on? There's no big battle. So he ends up, Veracruz ends up being surrendered to Scott. They raise the flag. The Navy's pumped, by the way. It's not that bloody. Oh, yeah. It's 9 killed on the U.S. side, 80 killed or wounded on the Veracruz side.
But you're not a single bar or cantina got hit either. The Navy was firing off because we know what we want when we get done.
So as the back of the Mexican army is breaking, Santa Anna arrives, and we end up with the Battle of Cerro Gordo. Santa Anna had hurried back after hearing about what was going on in Veracruz, and so he had reconstituted his troops after Buena Vista, and he goes to block the advancement of Scott in the mountains of the Veracruz province. He entrenches 12,000 men in a fairly strong, these are strong defensive positions, overseeing a mountain pass on basically the road to get out of the Veracruz province. Yeah. And it, imagine roads with these almost like massive cliffs, but massive slopes. And he plants cannons all over the place. And because what he wants to happen is Winfield Scott to walk into this area and basically be just surrounded all
ribbons from like every direction.
Yep. Yeah. And so he plants all these cannons, and the 8,500 man army that Winfield Scott has been able to get onto the shores, and he arrives, he kind of immediately senses like something's up here. So he orders a gentleman, I don't want to use the term gentleman, but he orders a young man named Captain Robert E. Lee to take a group of engineers and cut a new trail through the terrain. The Mexicans do not realize this, and he manages it by April 18th to get completely around the Mexican army. And he gets around. He launches a coordinated assault where he has General Twiggs' division storm from the flank, and while his forces hit from the front at the same time. Oh, the Mexicans don't know what to do, so they rout into the road, get swept in. It's almost kind of looking at a double team block where somebody chips to the linebacker. They get pushed off.
It's just been pancaked.
Yeah. Santa Anna's army just purely routs. They route. They go up the river. I'm sorry, up the path, and they run into the rear flank that had just cut this trail with Captain Robert Lee at the back. And they're like, oh. And I don't mean to sound dramatic, but they just like surrender.
I would.
They're just like, oh, cool. They were just like, oh, well, yep. That is.
This is hopeless.
So they're just like, brain cool. Check. So, Santa Anna ends up having to flee on a mule and abandoning his personal carriage. The U.S.
Is this where he left his leg behind, too?
This is where he left his leg behind. And can you just imagine the grunt who opened up the back of that carriage? He's like, dude, I found this guy's leg. Right? How much bear was struck out of that leg that night? God. This is what we have to study.
Right.
The Mexicans will see 1,200 killed and another 3,000 captured against 64 American casualties and 353 wounded. And this is what terrifies Santa Anna. That is about as good as a coup de grace you can get at any point in the war.
Yeah.
He marches on. And I think deep down, Santa Anna didn't think Winfield Scott was going to march, was going to keep marching on. He pursues Santa Anna. He pursues him for, honestly, he pursues him for the better part of 2.5 months.
He
suffers disease. There's constant there's just little raids and stuff like that.
Tell your disease to Taylor.
And then and tons of volunteers reach the end of their enlistment and are allowed to go home. About 3,200 troops are hospitalized. Scott keeps marching on. Scott's troops drain to only 5,800 men from his original 12,000. President Polk actually sent the State Department envoy, Nicholas Trist, to accompany Scott's army to start peace negotiations.
Right.
And basically, like, the Mexican officials are all open for it. They're like, yeah, let's have a conversation. Santa Anna keeps crushing them. He says, I'm the president. I want to, and basically forces the stalling tactic to start and reconstitute an army. And during the time period, he bolsters Mexico City's defense, rallies new troops. And by the time fresh U.S. enforcements arrive to bring Scott's strength back up to 10,000, the talks have completely stalled. Mm-hmm. And Polk, he's kind of like compelling Santa Anna, like, just surrender. What are we doing here?
Dude, it's like you can only hit a guy so many times in the face before you like start to feel bad about it.
Yeah, and by the time Winfield Scott reaches Mexico City, he has 10,000 troops. And this is when we'll see the battle, I can never pronounce the word, Churubusco.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when about 25, Santa Ana deployed 25,000 defenders around the terrain, lava fields, causeways, fortifications, anything you could find to basically stop the U.S. Army. And we see the first major clash is about like August 19-ish, 4,500 troops under General Smith basically do this like daring night raid where they run over volcanic rock and they hit the flank of a 5,000-man Mexican army. And in 17 minutes
what?
That morning, the U.S. overruns the Mexican camp and captures 800 prisoners and inflicts an additional 700 casualties on the Mexicans. 1,500 men lost in 17 minutes. Santa Anna doesn't care. He thinks it's a fluke. And I'm like, how many flukes do you have?
I know,
like, how
right? many? Yeah.
So
at this point, the best thing that can happen to Mexico is to get rid of this guy.
Honestly. So right now, they're a few miles away from Mexican City, the gates of Mexico City. Santa Anna rallies now about 20,000 troops to form. He falls it back, forms a defensive line and at a bridgehead. And he's like, we're going to stop them at this causeway. Now, if anybody knows, famously, Mexico City is kind of like, it was originally Tenochtitlan. It's kind of a flooded area, lower basin. It's very high up in altitude, but it's more like a lower basin. So this bridgehead is very important. Winfield Scott takes 8,500 troops and he presses them against the position. Ironically, this is where Irish volunteers fought against the U.S. military. Yeah, there was Irish volunteers who manned cannons.
Whoops!
In a convent to put up a fight against Scott's troops.
Ooh. All right. How are they fare?
Not well. Not well. Don't shoot cannons at the Americans. It's generally frowned upon. Winfield Scott presses into the frontal assault, collapses it in, and it results in Mexico losing 10,000 troops.
Holy crap.
In 2 days, they lost 10,000 troops.
It's half the force.
Yeah, with 4,200 being killed. America lost 131 troops were killed. By this point, Santa Anna's army falls back within the Mexican walls. Unilaterally, we declare a brief armistice.
Mm-hmm.
Santa Anna is completely unwilling to surrender, but he agrees to talk as a delaying tactic. Nicholas Trist, the U.S. diplomat, he basically meets with a bunch of Mexican commissioners, and he presents Polk's terms, which is basically the Rio Grande and the secession of California and New Mexico and the U.S. exchange for financial compensation. So he's like, we'll pay you for them, but we just want them. The Mexican government, it basically refuses to sign away half its country. And they're like, well, the capital's not occupied. And they're like, we're at your door. What do you want from us?
Right.
We crushed 15,000 of your 25,000. We lost like six dudes. I think some guys sprained their ankles. Like, what are you doing? This is not a fair war. Santa Anna manages to constitute his final defensive force of 15,000 to 20,000 troops.
God, he's still going.
Yeah, he's still going, which is wild to me. And this leads to what is the last battle of the war, Molino del Rey. This is September 8th, so this is very shortly after the negotiations fall apart. Basically, at this point, Polk's like, in the war, I'm done. We've sent diplomats.
Shoot Santa Anna, and that's good to be someone who'll negotiate.
He's like, we sent people there. You didn't want to negotiate. We took the Northern Territory. You didn't want to negotiate. We kicked you out of three states. You didn't want to negotiate. We literally attacked you till you were forced to negotiate with one of my negotiators. And you still don't. He's like, I'm done. He's like, I don't feel bad anymore. Take it. And Winfield Scott's like, I'll do that. That's not bad to me. Scott orders reconnaissance and force exercise against them. Which is basically reconnaissance troops that are reinforced with infantry. Yep. So they start mapping their way around Mexico City, and they get to a cannon foundry, which is Molino del Rey. It's an old mill complex at the foot of Mexico City, and American troops are sent under William Worth to attack these 3,000 defenders that are overseeing this old mill, and it's very bloody, close quarter fighting. But every time the U.S. gets in close, it's just so technologically superior that you end up with these horrific casualty numbers. 116 Americans are killed. Yeah. 2,000 Mexicans are killed. So two thirds of the troops stationed there, and another 700 are captured. Ironically, this triggers in other parts of Mexico City over 2,000 desertions because of this. So basically, as they were moving in to reinforce those troops, those 2,000 guys were like, I don't want to be involved in this. Did you see what happened there?
Yeah, forget that.
After this, they push forward. The Americans reconstitute for a few days, treat the wounded, reconstitute, and they move into Mexico City. Winfield Scott, taking a page out of Taylor's playbook, positioned artillery all around the city. He assaults the castle, the primary stead in the building on September 13th, which is also the Mexican Military Academy. In fairness to those young men in there, these were cadets. They didn't know how to fight. They certainly didn't know how to fight. Certainly didn't know how to fight a battle that started off with cannon fire to weaken their holdings. There was U.S. soldiers and Marines basically climbed up the rocky slope that was thought to be impregnable. Yeah. And which I think Marines just take that as like a threat. Like, what do you mean I can't climb up that thing? The U.S. Army too, the Rangers on Point Two Hawk. And so they climbed up what's essentially an edifice to get in there under cannon fire. And these poor cadets, they don't really know what to do. And the Marines actually carried ladders with them to then get onto the top of the building, climb up that rock into the edifice, and then climb even higher to the building, which must have been terrifying. So they couldn't even be bottlenecked in the building. They did face a lot of resistance, and these people are now celebrated as heroes, as cadets, because they heroically fought.
They should be. I mean, they.
And by late morning, the Americans had taken over, had raised a flag in the castle. Then the U.S. broke apart. The U.S., after the Marines and soldiers had taken basically the center stronghold, they broke apart and started hitting down the different causeways that make up Mexico City. Mexican defenders at the gate didn't even kind of understand what was happening. They were like, we're guarding this gate and these bridgeheads. Why are the Marines behind us? The U.S. is like, can you guys surrender? That'd be like super cool.
Please give up.
Please give up. I don't like doing this anymore.
Getting tired of shooting all of you.
Intelligently, a lot of these troops are like, do you know what? I think we got beaten. And Santa Anna's like, are you sure? It's like, I don't know what you want us to do. But a small group of very, I don't know if you want to call them crazy, I don't want to call them stupid, people with strong convictions, they end up holding up basically against the gates of the city. Yeah. And, it's about late September 13th, early September 14th. All the street combat erupts where these last few men are holding out. Two people fighting on the same team, Captain Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant, are basically coordinating or leading men throughout this. And Ulysses S. Grant helps bring in additional artillery and coordinate artillery strikes, on the gate defenses. The artillery is accurate, it's withering, it basically destroys all their defenses. And by the time the sun rises on September 14th, the Mexican army has fully evacuated, Mexico City has surrendered, the U.S. troops march into the capital, they raise the American flag over the national parallels. Santa Anna somehow survives this. He flees.
Still holding out?
He finally resigns as president. Oh,
thank God.
He tells his remaining 1,500 troops. He started.
How does he still have that many troops left?
He started with 25,000 a week ago, and he has 1,500. You know, they disband. There's this final skirmish where, like, these, after the troops, like, I don't know. I got two different timelines. I got, like, five different timelines. But basically, the troops were like, hey, we're disbanded. Let's go. Like, let's leave. And they ran into an American supply train, and they tried to fight it. And the American supply train kicked their teeth in. I think that's probably what happened.
Yeah.
I prefer the story is Santa Anna was like, oh, we have one last. Oh, maybe we can. Like, we weren't able to beat the army. We weren't able to beat the Marines. We weren't able to hold our city. We weren't able to beat the artillery. But let's go F up that supply train. And the supply train beat the shit out of him. He was like, I don't want to fight anymore. I don't want to fight anymore. Why are the logistics guys beating us up? and he ends the war, I think, on a very poetic note, which he goes, obviously, he said this in Spanish, not English, where he said, the Mexican resistance is practically at an end. That's how he was. Practically? What more do you want from us? So the war ends. U.S. military occupies the city. They end up coming up with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which is actually signed very shortly afterwards. I mean, by the time the war ends in September 14th, 1847. There's some guerrilla actions that General Scott sent to put out, but it's nothing of note or interesting. Yeah. And they negotiate. This gets signed, by the way, on September 2nd, 1848. So this is like
immediate negotiation. 2 weeks after that, yeah.
So you have the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. It took, you know, it basically is exactly the terms that Trist had lined up. We end up paying $15 million or about $490 million in today's dollars. Inflation's hard to calculate over that long time frame.
I hate that analogy, but yeah.
Mexico,
it's actually the same amount that we paid for the Gadsden Purchase.
Yeah, very much so.
Which is a much smaller amount of land.
Yes, but economically way more valuable land. Like, this is desert. We essentially bought desert. And yeah, he ends up, they end up seceding a huge amount of land. They're compensated for it. Even at the time, this is kind of funny to me. The U.S. agrees to pay $15 million to Mexico, and it assumed $3 million in American citizens' claims against the Mexican government. So, I don't know why I find that funny, but, like, the Mexican government's like, hey, some of you guys are suing us. It's like, yeah, no, we'll pay for that, too.
We'll
don't worry about that.
Yeah,
I'm like, kind of like a weird mood. Like, you just destroyed our army. Like, we had no chance of winning, and you're just like, we're fine.
We'll give you some money. It's cool.
So at the end of this very politically contentious war, but not militarily contentious, if I was to say a little bit. The U.S. adds 500,000 square miles of territory. And to this day, it is where the border stands, the Rio Grande. So I guess Polk was right?
No.
For everybody listening, I hope you taste the sarcasm with that. With that, I don't want somebody being like, oh, look, Eric wants a war of expansion. I'm like, no, I'm just saying, if Polk's argument was you can only keep what you can control, he was actually kind of nice about it. Apparently, he could have taken all of Mexico.
All right, well, I think that's probably going to do it for today's supersized episodio. So join us next week as we continue our quest to understand the great and not so great leaders of the United States. While you're patiently waiting for that, jump in the comments and try to guess what we're going to get wrong about Millard Fillmore. You can email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com with any famous people you think deserves a special. Smash those thumbs and subscribe on your way out. Visit the website to stay up to date, and we'll see everyone next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.